Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show. I am delighted to be joined today by Jim Stockton, Emeritus Lecturer in Philosophy at Boise State University in Idaho. He's recently written a very exciting new book, The Oxford University Socratic Club, 1942 to 1972, A Life. We're going to be talking to Jim about his work, as well as sharing a paper and a workshop that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Jim's paper was Beside the Meetings, the Oxford University Socratic Club's Lesser Known Events. And the title of his workshop there was Research Opportunities and the Oxford University Socratic Club, 1942 to 1972. Jim, there are clearly so many incredible people involved in the Socratic Club, but what, in your opinion, are some of the club's most exciting meetings?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's it. There's a meeting in the first year between Austin Farr and Robert Eisler. It was just feisty and a lot of fun. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know for certain, that they exchanged papers ahead of time. I counted the words that each of them, you know, received in the minutes, and it was, you know, almost exactly the same amount of time. And they got into it. And Eisler was a polymath and just a real character, brilliant guy, lived a tragic life, though. And he came to spend the last few years of his life during the war years after being in concentration camps he was Jewish. I've always felt that even though he died, I believe it was 45 or 46, going to the Socratic Club for him was one of the few joys that the man had toward the end of his life. He was hoping to get a full-time position teaching, but that didn't work out for him. And there's that one there. Then there's the famous one between C.E.M. Jode and C.S. Lewis on being reviewed by Christians. And just the whole story behind Jode and C.S. Lewis's friendship, both of them being on BBC, both of them being nationally recognized speakers, and hundreds of people showed up for that meeting, and it was one of the better ones. A guy by the name of Loon, I forget his first name, and J.D. Burnell, they had a very politically grounded as well as faith-grounded debate in the Oxford Union. Hundreds of people showed up for that, and it was supported by the student Christian movement, as well as the Rationalist Society, and there was one other society that was represented that evening. That was a lot of fun. The Foster Heirs debate happened right around the same time. That was a very exciting one. Then the lesser known debates, there's a debate where, not a debate, but there's a paper that a person gives on the, one of the scholars gives on the teleological argument. And Lewis gives a rather lengthy reply to. That one's really interesting because you get a really good idea of what Lewis thought about the teleological argument for the existence of God. There's another one where the person is talking about whether or not tautologies are necessary, logically speaking. And he's going on more or less using the tools of logical positivism. And Lewis just loses patience with them. And so that one's kind of fun to take a look at. The meetings between Price again and Lewis, those are really good. Anytime Eric Mascal showed up, that would be a good meeting. He was a lot of fun. Iris Murdoch was quite the crowd pleaser. I would say that Foote and Anscombe were the better philosophers, but Murdoch was good. And there was a great debate in the community about whether or not she should be calling herself a philosopher because she was also a novelist. And if you look at what's going on at the time, that was a rather almost misogynist view because you got other people, like C.S. Lewis, for example, writing novels that are very popular and, also doing his literary criticism. So, it just goes on from there. I think that there are some parts or some of the meetings that everyone's going to want to talk about or everyone's going to find interesting. There's about maybe 20 of them that would be in that category. But a lot of the meetings, they call for an acquired taste. And I've often thought about, well, what audience am I really serving and what good is the book? And the book is going to be, I think, a good resource for those who are working on Lewis biographies. And within Lewis studies, more specific articles about Lewis, it will give them a paragraph or two more to work off of, maybe some quotes from, maybe even, I think a lot of people will draw a lot of their own ideas for articles to write about Lewis from the book. Philosophers, a little bit less so for them as far as whether or not they're going to gain much from that. Philosophy as a general, philosophy doesn't do that much biography, and it works with the history of philosophy, of course, but it's more oriented towards arguments and problems and debate, issues debated. There are people out there, I've already talked to them. I'm hearing from people that are interested about Anscombe, interested about Foote, interested about Gilbert Ryle, Ayres, and Bernard Williams, and whatever they might be working on. I wrote a couple papers about McIntyre's involvement in the Socratic Club and went to the International Society for McIntyrian Inquiry, which is kind of like a Notre Dame alumni festival every year. And I shared that material with them. They were very, very receptive, very appreciative. And I know that in a few years, we're going to start seeing McIntyre biographies. And I'm hoping that my work, sheds a little bit of light on what he did when he was younger. And so that's what the book has to offer.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, The New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. Thank you for helping people engage God's Word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Jim, one of the debates that people are probably aware of, or some people may be aware of, is the famous 1948 debate with philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, where Lewis debates Elizabeth Anscombe. Would you mind just briefly summarising their discussion and sharing your own analysis of what you think happened, and then also what the consequent repercussions were? Because I know you've got some really interesting thoughts on that, haven't you?
Yes, and the meeting occurred February 2nd, 1948, and it was a, you know, what's often called a call for correction, or she was pointing out errors that she had found in Chapter 3 of the first edition of Miracles. In there, Lewis makes the mistake of associating causation to aspects of his argument that doesn't make any sense. I would have to go back to my notes. I'm, for some reason, pulling a blank here in my head. That happens with this particular debate for me from time to time. But he almost anthropomorphizes reason and gives reason causal properties or causal capabilities, so as to make his argument for God's existence by rationalizing what is occurring within a miracle. And she quickly, in her paper, points out to him that reason doesn't cause things. Reason onto itself doesn't think and doesn't act in the way that he is speaking about. And then there are other lesser issues, but they're still important ones to bring up. He talks about full explanation of what's occurring in the rationalization of God's existence. And she correctly points out there's no such thing as a full explanation to this sort of line of reasoning. And her paper is straightforward and on point. And I think when Lewis read it, he knew that was the case. He went there that evening. In my book, I point out, I think he went there thinking he was going to argue with a philosopher about David Hume's famous rebuttal against miracles, or Augustine on reason and God's existence, you know, sort of that type of debate he remembered from his undergraduate and early years at the university. I don't know if you read the article ahead of time, but what he got was I thought it was rather mild and polite dressing down, or not having used his language correctly, which happens to all of us, by the way. I know a few philosophers out there who like to think that they always get their language to correct by the final draft, but I can assure you that, you know, the type of error that Lewis made was not uncommon. And it wasn't really, in a lot of ways, as big of an issue that it would end up being seen as being by critics in the 70s and 80s. And so they're at the meeting, and they're arguing over words and terms at the end of her presentation. And I write a little bit about that. But the one thing that he didn't want to give up was this quote that he got from Haldane, which I'd have to go find it, but it basically says, you know, if I'm nothing but a matter of atoms and atoms are within my brain, you know, if the atoms don't exist, then I don't exist, nor does my thinking exist. Therefore, I can't argue against God's existence and claim I'm just nothing but a bunch of atoms at the same time. And she hints at that being problematic, which most people, even quite a few in Lewis studies, recognize as being problematic, but they don't really go there in the debate. Now, the debate was well attended. It was well received. It was exciting. I have letters from people who were at the debate. I've read through a lot of the material that is available out there. And then you don't hear anything about it. And a few people, Mascal in the 50s, he writes a little bit about it. A couple other people, you know, mention it in passing. One of the points that was brought up in the 50s and 60s was in Miracles, Lewis is adopting what they call a triumphal apologetic voice, you know, and he's big and he's strong and he's, you know, for Christ and he will argue for God and miracles. That's the type of persona that goes into the book. And we don't do that very much anymore, but Lewis comes from a generation of men who took on huge ideas that were going to change the world, and they were big personalities. And so that was kind of what was at, you know, risk for him. I think the meeting humbled him a little bit, but it didn't destroy him. It isn't the reason, like Wilson puts forward, that he turned to writing children's books. He wrote children's books because he loved children's books. And he took it in stride. He had, you know, more than one, you know, fall in his career. He didn't do very well on a popular show on BBC, and he bounced back from that and did quite well afterwards, as we all know. Anscombe, you know, if you're looking at it straightforwardly, she won the day. Her call for correction was on point. The issues she brought forward, they are credible. And you would think it would stop there. But out comes Humphrey Carpenter, and he says that, you know, it served the terrible blow to Lewis. And he quotes people, you know, saying that Lewis was absolutely devastated. Well, a year later, Walter Hooper comes to Lewis's defense and says, no, it was a sort of a draw. Half of the people there, you know, said Lewis won the day. The other half say that Anscombe won the day. And then it started to snowball. And in the 80s and early 90s, Lewis studies, people within that community, begin to write and talk about it quite a bit. I think it's fair to say now that most people that I've talked to in Lewis studies are tired of hearing about the Anscombe debate. They're tired of hearing about all the stories that followed about Lewis after that meeting. I can assure you that almost all the philosophers I've talked to, they don't care much about it at all. And they just accept it straightforwardly for what it is. And I've even talked to some philosophers who are much more knowledgeable about Anscombe, her work, and her life than I'll ever be. But they see it as a bit of a just a small swath of tarnish on Anscombe's brilliant career. You know, if you want to talk about Anscombe, shut up about this damn debate in 1948 and start talking about what she did on causation. Start talking about what she did when it came to moral philosophy and so many other, you know, contributions that she made to the discipline. Mm-hmm. And she was original, and that is very rare in philosophy. Most of the people I know in philosophy, they produce good work, but to, you know, produce truly original philosophical argument is only a handful each generation get around to doing that. And so that's the sort of the story behind the debate. The entire time, this is interesting, this should come up because I have kind of an announcement upon the heels of that. The entire time that I've been working on the book, I've been sending chapters out, even in their rough draft, to a group of colleagues, both philosophers and people in Lewis studies. And the going consensus I've had from a lot of people is cut back on the Anscombe-Lewis debate. I write, they've told me I have too much in the book about it. And I'm going through my very last revision of the book right now. And I got the license to do this from my editor, but I'm going to be trimming it back quite a bit. And just between us, we used to joke about, you know, maybe what you should do is just write three paragraphs on the debate and leave it at that. Sort of my way of saying, this is it, in three paragraphs, move on. But I do believe it was, an interesting topic. I respect those readers who are intrigued by them. And there's been some good work that's been done on debate as well. Different philosophers out there have made some good contributions.
Jim, do we know why the Oxford University Socratic Club came to an end?
Yeah, there were another thing that Hooper says in Oxford's Bonnie Fighter, which was more or less the primary source for the Socratic Club, that lengthy articles of his for about 30 or 40 years. And then other sources started popping up, more of them, but it still remains a primary source for it today. But he says that after Lewis left for Cambridge, the club went into decline. The club was going at it, and I proved this much in the book, all the way up until about 67, 68. Then the student protest at Oxford and Cambridge come about, demanding more liberty. What a lot of Americans don't know is that in Oxford and Cambridge at that time, there was a parental authority that the university took on when it came to the movements and the activities of the students. And they told them they had to stay in during the weekdays. They told them to stay out of the pubs. They told them a lot of different things. And the students, as you would imagine, they were watching all of these protests, especially elsewhere in the world. They were going on throughout the world, but especially in America. And they said, hey, we're going to do that as protest as well. And that's when you start to see a decline throughout a lot of student clubs. And some of the more famous clubs, the ones that have been there for generations, they change and modify and survive. And a lot of the club, a good handful of clubs, they came to an end. And so by the time we get to 69, 1970, there is so much going on between not only the students protesting for more rights and liberties for themselves, but against the war, civil rights, and the like, that there was less of an interest in these old school type of clubs where you meet in a room, but the common room they share.
The common room, yeah. Some of them have a few different common rooms.
Right, yeah. And, you know, that starts to be pushed aside for the, you know, exciting protests that are going on. But also the other thing that brought the end to a lot of clubs like the Socratic was television. And I think television, you know, changed the world, the 1960s and 70s. And by the time we get out of the 70s and we're going into the 80s, it's over, you know. TV has, you know, won, and its effect is on society has taken hold. Even today, you know, clubs aren't as popular, you know, in America, for example, as they used to be because of that, because of all the alternatives people have. A lot more alternatives now than they had back in the 70s. Mm. And the other thing that was occurring was philosophy didn't necessarily slow down from 67 to throughout the early 70s. Matter of fact, that's what we call it in the 60s, the linguistic turn. And a lot of philosophy is going on at that time, and it's very exciting. A lot of philosophy of mind, language, playing new games, if you will, and metaphysics. But that type of philosophy isn't exciting to an undergraduate student who's doing PPE or reading in history or, you know, some other discipline than philosophy, than, you know, listening to two middle-aged guys go at it, you know, about Christianity. So, you know, philosophy itself changes the topic. There's less philosophy of religion. It's there, but it's just not as popular as linguistic philosophy was during the 60s. So my experience in the 22 years I taught at Boise State, I retired in 2019, was is the kids today going to university still want to talk about religion? they still want to hear the arguments. And I could say that now that I'm retired. I'd be a bit more cautious. So Boise State is a large public university. So I felt very fortunate to be able to teach courses like C.S. Lewis and philosophy. My university was very open-minded. I know other universities that are not very open-minded about that type of thing in the States.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work. Not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.